Let me try that again now that I'm not muted. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It appears that we are ready to begin with the fourth matter on our oral argument calendar. The court has checked connections with all counsel, and I know you've likely appeared before us before and are familiar with our proceedings by video conference. Really, everything remains the same, and we do continue to record the proceedings, and that recording, audio recording, is made available on the website. I do ask you, the court asks you, to identify yourself for the record as well as the client you represent before you begin your argument and to keep an eye on the clock. The time tends to go quickly. So we have two respondents counsel today, and they have an agreement on sharing time for the respondents portion. So that will be 11 minutes and 4 minutes, and the marshal will set the clock accordingly to let you know how your time is progressing during our conversation. So with that, I think we're ready to proceed. I'll ask the marshal to call the fourth case on our calendar.
Now calling A21-0397, Fernhill Place Retail Association, Inc. Appellant versus Fernhill Place Homeowners Association, Inc. et al. Respondents, the Cincinnati Insurance Company respondent.
Counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
John Mack for the RA, may it please the court. Because I have only 15 minutes, I'm going to start my presentation with the count three issue before the court. Count three was, of course, an action for damages against the RA for not completing the repairs as required and by diminishing the value of the property by not applying the final insurance disbursement to be made for the repair completion. Here's what the judge said. Pursuant to the party's agreement on the record during the October 29th, 2020 hearing, the checks at issue in plaintiff's count three in the amounts of $40,774 and $40,774.38 and the additional amount of $32,541.92 for a depreciation.
Well, Mr. Mack, if you don't mind, I'm sorry. What page are you reading from the transcript?
I'm reading from page 13 of my brief.
Okay. Oh, from your brief. All right. But you're quoting the transcript, right? From the hearing?
Yes, I'm quoting the transcript.
Okay.
And I'm also quoting from the complaint.
Right.
But I'm quoting it in my brief.
Right. So I think what you're getting to is what were the district court's comments at the hearing with regard to count three, right?
And that was also in her order and judgment.
Right. What caught my attention, if you don't mind, because I certainly have read your brief as well as your complaint. But what caught my attention in the hearing transcript is on page 51 of the transcript. I don't know if you have it available to you. Do you?
Not right now. No, I'm sorry.
Okay. And so let me just tell you what I read there. And I'll read part of it out loud. Is the court says to the parties at the end of the hearing, I do urge the folks concerned with where those funds are in dispute in count three, maybe should be to follow up promptly and see if you reach an agreement on them. If you can't reach an agreement, please let me know because I will take count three, the count three claim under advisement as well. But based on what I heard today, both sides saying during the argument, it seems that there are grounds for reaching an agreement. So tell me what, I know you weren't, you were not the lawyer arguing at this hearing. I appreciate that, but I'm sure you're familiar with the record.
Sure.
What happened? Well, did the parties get back to the district court and tell them what to do, tell the court what to do on count three? She's obviously ready to take it under advisement and decide it on the merits.
That I don't know. I also don't know if the court got back to counsel saying, will you let us know one way or the other? Perhaps it did.
No, the court told the parties to get back to the court. I mean, I just read you that. That is exactly what the judge said. So what did plaintiff do? It's your claim. So what did you do?
Well, I don't know if it got back to the court or not, but I guess the point that I'm making is whether or not they got back to the court didn't rule on it. Another issue.
The court did not rule on the merits as of the summary judgment order. The court clearly indicates that the parties had reached an agreement.
But the agreement that they reached was an escrow agreement. It wasn't an agreement on the merits, which had been raised by my party in the initial pleadings.
So let me just take you at your word, and that count three does in fact state a claim for damages in addition to a request for an escrow of the check. So let me assume that's true. Okay. You could settle that claim for just escrowing the funds, right?
That part of it, certainly.
Yeah. No, you can settle the whole claim. You can always compromise your claim, right?
I don't understand, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, in settlement, you can compromise any claim. So you could state a claim in a complaint and then settle it for something slightly different from what the
certainly, state. But we didn't.
Yeah, but that's what the district court judge says in the order. And it, the transcript suggests that that's is supported by the transcript of the hearing.
But if the parties don't settle it, there is an obligation on the part of the court to rule on the issue, and it didn't. I would like to turn to the meat of it, because frankly, I think that this is fairly close to an issue of a first impression. I argue that this action was essentially one to require the proceeds of the insurance policy, whatever that is, we don't know that yet, to be applied against the judgment that Judge Klein ordered against my client. Obviously, in this case, and we figured it would be raised, the defendant raises the issue of res judicata. Here's why that doesn't apply.
So more specifically, I think counsel, the district court relied on collateral estoppel.
And that may be, I think in law school, I was taught that the collateral estoppel.
There's a difference.
Branch
go ahead.
The issue is this. Obviously, in this case, I'm sure that Cincinnati paid all or part of the judgment in this case, or excuse me, all or part of the amount owed to the HOA in this case. And if it did, then it became subrogated to all or part of that that particular recovery. Now, here's the issue. The cases on subrogation that I'm able to find says that the subrogated party then becomes in the shoes of and substituted for the claimant. If that's true, then the HOA does not have a claim anymore. The claim is exclusively Cincinnati's claim. If that claim is true, if what I'm saying is true, and I believe it is, then the HOA does not have a claim against my client anymore. And to the extent that Cincinnati paid the HOA, my client should not have to pay it.
So Mr. Mack, that's not my understanding of how subrogation works, but to getting to the collateral estoppel issue, because that's the basis that our district court ruled against you, wasn't that issue raised and decided in the, I'd call it the Fernhill 2?
No, it wasn't. In Fernhill 2, the issue is whether or not my client had to pay a judgment against the HOA. This case is one for a satisfaction of judgment, and the judgment has been wholly or partially satisfied by the amounts paid by Cincinnati.
So you'll have to help me out there. I am not familiar with case law that says you, your client, may rely on fees paid by under an insurance policy to Fernhill to satisfy your judgment. I mean, the judgment has been entered against your client based on their liability under the statute. So how would they be able to satisfy the judgment based on any, if insurance proceeds were paid? And let's just assume they were for those attorney's fees.
Because the HOA has been paid by Cincinnati for all or part of the amounts that my client owes against them.
Yeah, but they aren't acting on your behalf. They're paying under a policy. That's a whole different contractual relationship.
But if they have so paid, then at that point, the action is wholly Cincinnati's action and the HOA.
And that's where I disagree with you. That's not how subrogation works. It doesn't become the action of the insurer. I mean, we see that all the time in just a simple automobile accident case, say healthcare is paid for as a result of the auto accident case. Those healthcare providers and insurers are entitled to subrogation for the medical expenses that are paid during the lawsuit, but they don't become parties to the lawsuit. They have a subrogated.
But the point is, I'm sorry. But the point is, once those payments are made, and the same is true in an auto accident case, there is no longer a direct cause of action between the party, the plaintiff, and the defendant in this case. If that's true, and the sole action against my client has become Cincinnati's, then it is no longer the HOA's. And if it's no longer the HOA's, it's been effectively paid. I mean, what we're talking about here, and we're trying to avoid, is double recovery. Obviously, Cincinnati would have a right against my client, didn't bring it, but could. And in this particular case, the HOA, if it would recover, and Cincinnati, if it would recover the same amounts. And that would be double recovery, which is something that courts don't like very much.
So what concerns me, counsel, is that your client has been found liable under the statute for attorney's fees. That was fully litigated in the second action. To the extent you wanted to make some argument, which you did actually, about some subrogation interest that would have undermined that liability, Judge Klein rejected it in Fernhill 2. And there's an extended paragraph in his decision in which he rejects that argument. So
but what he says in
convince me that that's not the same issue. I'm still not following it.
I don't see where it is the same issue, because what he said is that subrogation with regard to Fernhill 1 is not at issue. And in this case, subrogation is an issue. Now, we're not arguing for or against subrogation here, but we're saying that the fact of subrogation and the law of subrogation needs to be applied against the judgment against my client. I want to note one more thing before I finish my argument. I made the argument already that the judge didn't rule on the issue of whether or not there was damages. The other thing that the judge did not rule on is the issue of attorney's fees in this case. And it seems to me, she has that under advisement, by the way, now. And it's a very tricky issue involving Haugen Nutrition and the bank. But ordinarily, you would expect that all of these issues would be determined by the district court before it issues a final judgment. I'm concerned that we don't really have, as to all issues, a final judgment here.
So, counsel, that sounds like a new issue. I didn't see that in the briefs.
No, I'm just, but okay. You did see in my brief with regard to count 3.
Yes. Oh, definitely. I read your argument there. So, but and
I'm just saying that as long as we're dealing with count 3, I would bring this up to the court. One more thing I'd like to say. Subrogation is an equitable issue. And in this case, the application of res judicata and collateral estoppel should not be applied. As I argued below, I think that Judge Klein was simply wrong when he relied on that statutory provision. And the reason he was wrong in relying on that statutory provision is it does not relate to an action between the parties. It relates to the kind of thing that a consumer or a member of the HOA would bring, indicating that there's a problem with it. The other reason why I think this is inequitable in this case is because the double recovery issue, which I brought up before, just seems to me to say, why should my client have to pay $250,000 twice, especially since, in my judgment, he didn't do anything wrong. I'll take questions for my last 2 minutes.
Is there anything from the panel?
So, Mr. Mack, you started, I think, the last paragraph of talking about that you just thought Judge Klein was wrong. And I understand you feel that way, but if he was wrong, that's decided, that's final. I mean, aren't you just taking us back to trying to relitigate what Judge Klein decided?
Yes,
and even
no.
If it was inequitable, if it was, you know, wrong, the appeal's passed, it's over.
Yeah, the issue is this, though. When we have an issue such as subrogation, such as a new suit and so forth, and you're trying to apply res judicata or collateral estoppel, there's an equitable issue. And if that issue is based upon an incorrect determination, we shouldn't follow the incorrect determination all the way through the future. So even if that was final, and there's no doubt that Fern 1 is final, this one, in this case, should not be applied. I guess what I'm saying is the court has the option not to impose res judicata and collateral estoppel. Anything further?
Doesn't look like it, Mr. Mack. So of course you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So we look forward to continuing the conversation at that point.
Thank you.
And we'll set the clock for 11 minutes. There we go. So with that, I think we're ready to begin with counsel for respondent, and you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge Bradford. May it please the court. My name is Mark Bradford. I represent the respondent, Fernhill Place Homeowners Association. This court should affirm the district court's order dismissing the retail association's complaint in all respects. The district court correctly determined at addendum page 4 that, quote, counts 1 and 2 of the RA's complaints in this action challenge the propriety of a prior order entered by another judge of this court in a previous litigation, end quote. That determination is spot on. Three courts have now held that the RA has improperly used subsequent cases to relitigate the very issues that Judge Klein decided concerning the HOA's right to recover attorney's fees. Appellant's brief illustrates our point that the RA is attempting to relitigate the precise issues Judge Klein decided. Page 10 of appellant's brief, and you just heard it again here in argument, states, an important reason the Court of Appeals should not apply the rules of res judicata and collateral estoppel is because Judge Klein made an erroneous statutory interpretation. If that argument sounds familiar, it's because it's the very argument the RA made when it did take an appeal back in 2018 of Judge Klein's attorney's fees order. It chose to limit its challenges to that order to whether the HOA was a prevailing party. It did not raise any other issues regarding the propriety of that order, such as the judge's conclusion that the parties are not co-insureds, that the covenants do not apply, that there's no problem with recovering attorney's fees where the party seeking those fees is insured. None of those arguments were raised in the first appeal. And the issue regarding Judge Klein's statutory interpretation was directly addressed by this court 3 years ago, where the court said at page 8 of its decision, page 8 is the Westlaw citation, we agree with the district court's construction of Minnesota statute section 515B. So really what this appellant is doing is doubling down, not only challenging Judge Klein's rulings that were made 4 years ago, but now apparently challenging a ruling from a panel of this court 3 years ago. The same issues are involved in both cases. The argument, as I read appellant's brief, and you heard the argument again today, there's a general prohibition on a double recovery such that a party seeking fees cannot recover those fees from another party in the litigation where it's insured. Judge Klein directly addressed that issue, stating there is no prohibition in the act on an award of attorney's fees that are covered by insurance. That's at addendum page 23. I'd note there are two addendum page 23s in appellant's addendum, so I'm not sure if it's really page 23 or 24, but it's right in Judge Klein's order. He addressed that very issue. Appellants state in their brief that the covenants, that the declaration and the subrogation waiver applies. Judge Klein found that it didn't, and there was no appeal. These are the very issues that were litigated in the first case, then again in the bankruptcy case, then again most recently in front of Judge Christian Sanda. This case, in our view, illustrates why the doctrine of collateral estoppel applies. A party can't raise defenses to an attorney's fee award, appeal on a different issue, sit on its hands with respect to adverse rulings on those issues, and then serially litigate those very issues in subsequent proceedings. I want to just say a few words about count three, which appellant began his remarks addressing. And Judge Bradfield, to answer your question about what was submitted to the district court, and I will tell the court I looked for the same thing, and unfortunately it's not in the record. But to answer your question, Judge Bradfield, there were a series of emails directed to the judge and the judge's clerk, essentially identifying what the parties had agreed to. Unfortunately, that's not part of the district court record because they're in emails. But let me say this about count three. If you look at the complaint, and I'm referring to page 10, paragraph 12, and page 11, paragraph 2, the only damages alleged in that count are for the amounts of the checks that were allegedly erroneously deposited. The parties agreed to resolve that claim by placing those funds into escrow. In the response brief, one thing I do want to clarify procedurally is the HOA brought a motion to dismiss counts 1 and 2 on Rule 12. It brought a summary judgment motion with respect to count 3. So it's not enough for Mr. Mack to say, we pled damages, we pled diminution in value. Counsel for HOA argued at the hearing that there's no evidence of damages in this record. That's at page 15 of the transcript. There was no response to that argument at oral argument. Instead, the response brief on that point says, quote, the RA is justly entitled to continue its claim, referring to count 3, until either it receives proof that the repairs were made or is paid the sum on a check that was wrongfully endorsed and deposited. So they made it very clear that count 3 was just dependent on either the repairs being made or them being paid a portion of the funds that were deposited. The court asked the parties to resolve that and said on page 23 of the transcript, it seems to me that count 3, on that count, there isn't a whole lot of underlying dispute. And that's because the party said, as long as the funds that were paid are deposited into escrow, it resolves the damages that the plaintiff was seeking in count 3 of the complaint. So it did resolve, the court did resolve every claim, every issue that the RA was seeking in count 3. There simply is no basis upon which to reverse the district court's order below. And really the only sort of new argument that's been raised is, well, collateral estoppel can't apply because Cincinnati wasn't a party to the first proceeding. That confuses the concepts of offensive and defensive collateral estoppel. Of course, the party who is estopped was a party at every stage of every proceeding. There's no dispute that all of the disputed funds were placed into escrow pursuant to the court's order. All of the relief sought in count 3 has been satisfied, and all of the relief set forth in counts 1 and 2 are correctly barred by the doctrine of collateral estoppel. Unless there are any courts, I'll yield the balance of my time.
Are there any questions from the panel? I think we're ready. And if the marshal is able to add the 4 minutes on top of wherever we just were, that will give counsel for Cincinnati a bit more time than perhaps expected. But... All right, looks like we are set at 7 minutes for you. So counsel for Cincinnati, respondent, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. David Watson, WATSON, on behalf of respondent Cincinnati Insurance Company. I believe Mr. Mack kind of struck really to the heart of this issue when he argued again about really attacking Judge Klein's order regarding attorney's fees. I'd like to start out first by pointing out that the appellant admits right away at the outset that it does not claim any relief against Cincinnati. And though the district court didn't really consider that argument, there really isn't anything. There are no meets. There's nothing directed at Cincinnati. There's no claim for relief. There are no real allegations specific to Cincinnati. In fact, Cincinnati was not a party to the previous lawsuit. So if there were any allegations of fraud present in the previous lawsuit, those would be directed to other people. So really dismissal of the complaint is warranted. I know that counsel has raised the argument at multiple stages that discovery should have been granted prior to Judge Miller's order. Of course, Cincinnati's motion, much like Mr. Bradford's motion relating to counts 1 and 2, was a motion to dismiss. And so looking at the allegations on the face of the complaint and comparing that to the issues determined in Judge Klein's order, Judge Miller correctly determined that this really is an issue of collateral estoppel. Collateral estoppel is not an issue of first impression before the court. Really, the elements, I think, are each met. I don't want to belabor those because Mr. Bradford has gone through each of them. I would like to say that, as the court has pointed out, the issue of subrogation, as comes up at various times throughout the briefing, addresses this broad idea that any type of subrogation has been waived in any case whatsoever between these parties. By way of example, if there was an auto accident, as the court had indicated, and there were medical payments made, if there was some type of subro waiver in a construction agreement between those parties involved in the accident, it would be ludicrous to apply it to that situation. At the end of appellant's reply brief, beginning on page 3 and continuing on to page 4, it indicates that subrogation violates paragraph 6, parent D, parent 2 of the easement agreement. The language of the easement agreement, which is actually attached directly to the complaint in this matter, deals with property subrogation. It starts out and it talks about subrogation related to damages to the property and insurance related to that. I think simply it's inapplicable. Subrogation is inapplicable in this case. And Judge Klein correctly went through each of those elements. One last thing I would like to address before concluding here is the idea that Cincinnati was not a party to the previous lawsuit is really irrelevant, because under the elements of collateral estoppel, as Mr. Bradford had pointed out, it says the party to be estopped. And if it really meant both parties had to be part of the previous lawsuit, I think the case law would all point that out. I think there is that requirement within res judicata. However, the elements, as it's pointed out on page 7 and 8 of our brief, indicate that it really is about the party to be estopped, which is the standard that the court applied in this case in dismissing the complaint. And so we respectfully request that Cincinnati, that the judge's order be affirmed dismissing Cincinnati from this matter. There's really no basis for Cincinnati to be in this case. And in addition, all the arguments raised have been previously addressed by Judge Klein in the Court of Appeals and now by Judge Miller. And we humbly request that the order be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the panel? Okay, very good. Thanks to both attorneys for respondent. And I think we will reset the clock for you, Mr. Mack, and we'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I know that you can't ask questions, or I can't ask questions of the other party, but I think the following is at least something that the court should bear in mind. Does Cincinnati intend to go against my client on the basis of subrogation? Because it seems to me that there's no doubt that that Cincinnati has a right of subrogation in this case. They paid the HOA after all. But we have to protect ourselves against Cincinnati if Cincinnati intends to do that. I also wanted to take a minute to talk about why we think that Cincinnati was a necessary party in this case. Suppose that the court hadn't granted summary judgment. Suppose that the court thought that either the doctrine of collateral estoppel was not applicable in this case, or that it should be waived for equitable reasons. The argument was, of course, that Cincinnati had in fact paid the HOA, and we certainly would have had a right to find out from Cincinnati whether the HOA was paid in whole or in part by Cincinnati. Now, I grant, if the court agrees with the defendants here, that summary judgment was proper, yes, then there's no point to Cincinnati being in the suit. But in the event that they would, this court would disagree and say that summary judgment should be reversed, then and in that event, it seems to me that Cincinnati is a necessary party because we're talking about Cincinnati's money. Now, turning to count three, it seems to me that there is no way that we can successfully argue that Judge Miller determined that. All the judge said in her judgment was that the parties should get together and resolve this. But this isn't just about putting the money in escrow. By paragraph 41, for example, of our complaint, Mr. Drewis says the following: by not completing the repairs, the retail association has been damaged, one, by the diminished value of the property, and two, by not receiving the benefit of the final insurance disbursements to be made by Cincinnati Insurance Company upon repair completion. Repair hasn't been completed, and we would have had the right to some of that money ourselves, not just put in escrow. Finally, repairs haven't been made, and it seems to me, therefore, we have a cause of action to either require them to make those repairs or to pay us the value of the damages we suffered. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our thanks to all lawyers in this case. This matter is now submitted to this court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
You, Your Honor.
So with that, the Court of Appeals has concluded its oral argument calendar for today, and we will be in recess for our non-oral conference.